But by the time we've reached this moment of the death of God, we already have a strange change in the discourse. What new games, new festivals, what could be invented now to make up for what has already been destroyed? What myths could we construct ourselves? What games? What holy festivals? What interesting books, fascinating arguments, and new ways to live, other than the pathetic, tragic, stupid, banal array of ordinary, everyday, bourgeois, stinking life? Surely, we can do better than that.
Hello and welcome to the 220th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. My son Noah's with me this week. Say hello, Noah.
Hello.
And we are going to introduce you to the episode together, right?
Yes.
This week, Karl Marx and Hegel are the subjects, and I talked to Andy Marshall about Marx's critique. Don't play with those pennies. I talked to my friend Andy Marshall about Marx's critique of Hegel's philosophy in general. This conversation comes on the heels of a Facebook row with C. Derek Varn, wherein Varn took the widely accepted position that Marx is a materialist and Hegel is an idealist, while I argued that Marx was too enamored with Hegel's dialectical logic and the unity of subject and object to really escape the Platonic realm entirely.
I did not do the research with you. I do not know what you're talking about.
Thanks. It's Monday, September 1st, 2014.
That's very great.
And I'm Douglas Lane, the host of the Diet Soap Podcast.
Yes, of course you are.
I'd like to thank Andy Marshall, Penny R., Reagan S., and Shane S. for their generous one-time donations to the Diet Soap Podcast. And to thank Andy Marshall, Ted F., John Spillane, Jacob L., and John L. for their recurring donations. I urge regular listeners to the podcast to find the PayPal buttons at dietsoap.podomatic.com. Also, the podcast is available via iTunes and on Stitcher. And I urge people who enjoy the show to consider leaving a review at iTunes or at Stitcher in lieu of a donation. In the words of the Marxist humanist Raya Dunayevskaya, Marxist humanism was neither a rejection of idealism nor an acceptance of materialism, but the truth of both, and therefore a new unity. The music you're listening to right now is from Sariak's YouTube video, Chimpnology. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Andy and I discuss Karl Marx's reluctant idealism. Great. Well, I'm glad to talk to you about Marx and Hegel, kind of a in-between workshop, I guess, not on Talk Show.
Well, you know, I read through the little bit of an argument you had, and I must admit that I actually kind of needed you to explain what was going on kind of in person, because in the thing there was a lot going on, but I didn't, you know, I'm not familiar with Marx. And so I thought maybe it would be both interesting, because it was related to our Hegel that we've read so far.
Did you get a chance to read the Marx essay, the critique of Hegel's philosophy in general?
Yes, I'm on my second or third reading of it, I read it all the way through, and I was like, "This is the worst written thing I've ever come across. It makes no sense." And then I started reading the footnotes, and especially the first footnote, and I'm like, "Oh, this is his private journal or whatever, you know, or he meant to write something, and these are the notes for that something, right?" So it makes sense why it doesn't flow together, like usually there's a thread that ties it all together. I mean, the ideas in it are interesting, but
yeah, in a sense, we're reading Marx's Facebook posts or something on this. Rather, like my argument with Varn was incomprehensible, probably for the same reason that this is so difficult. You know, it's just scattered thoughts and
Right, right. Well, you know, I listened to a lot of podcasts, and there was a podcast on Buddhism. I think I actually sent you the link before I actually knew you or whatever. It was about organizational thinking, right? And you know, ever since that podcast, I've been very picky on when you're in an argument that it doesn't become an everybody hates me argument. You just keep on piling new non-related things that bother you, right, into the thing. You know, so if you're having a genuine dispute, you need to start separating out and start resolving particular parts of that dispute rather than, yeah, the normal thing that happens on Facebook. And I get really irritated with Facebook arguments for that reason, is that they basically are not productive normally. I mean, and that's not to say you can't have a good argument. And I know recently there's some, at least beta versions of Facebook where you can reply to particular posts if it gets too big, if the main thing gets too big. And I like that. I wish I was just available all the time on Facebook, because that would really resolve one of my biggest issues, is that you start with an argument and then it leads to premises, and then people want to deal with individual premises. You do so all at once, right? You don't just start talking about one premise, because there's always that fear that that person's going to, come back with 500 different things, you know, so you got to be quick with it. I don't know. Anyway, I have complaints.
The essay is kind of a mess, and it's also very, really difficult. Even if it wasn't a mess, the concepts in it are hard. And Marx does the same thing that so many people do, especially on Facebook, but in arguments in general, is he makes a lot of assertions. Without arguing for them very much. And that when he gets to the argument for them, he actually kind of shifts what he's arguing a bit, I think. So, you know, at the top of this essay, he kind of just numbers out things that Feuerbach has, the proof that philosophy is nothing else but religion rendered into thought and expounded by thought. And then as he goes in, he has to say more nuanced things as he tries to explain why Hegel ends up where he does. And so maybe what I'd like to do now is just say briefly what I think Karl Marx is arguing. I think he's arguing a couple of things. One of them is that Hegel is not sufficiently a materialist, and that he sides with thinking and thought and the universal so much that he ends up with only a formal or abstract understanding or moment of absolute or unity. Because, you know, the whole aim of the Hegelian dialectic is to try to bring together the objective world with the subjective world of man. And that's something that Karl Marx shared with Hegel. He was a libertarian, Marx was. He wanted people to be free to influence and shape their own world. But that's the first thing I think Marx is saying here, is that whereas a good materialist would be able to come to an understanding of man's role in the world that would liberate man, all that Hegel had was an abstraction or a formula or a mental understanding of it. And that this came from the fact that he was an idealist and put too much emphasis on philosophical kind of thinking.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, if there was no other point that he made, that was definitely one that he made, was, I mean, including the Feuerbach stuff, you definitely felt that what he was saying against what Marx was saying against Hegel was that basically there's some sort of delusional world that he's still believing, or transcendent world that he's still believing in, and there's a section deep down towards, I think it's towards the end, where it's particularly like hard to follow for me, just because of like how much he's arguing against Hegel, kind of believing in this transcendent world so much that there is no I don't know, real things in the world anymore.
What I found fascinating about this is reading this was a lot like reading the Phenomenology.
Which is funny because the first thing you read in here is how he's arguing how people are still talking like, you know, they've swallowed Hegel so much that they keep talking like him. But yes, yeah, there's no doubt that when you read any philosopher that you kind of pick up their jibs and jabs a little bit, I think, yeah.
Hegel, and I wish I memorized the Phenomenology, but I know that Hegel goes through many steps where consciousness or self-consciousness comes to a point where what seems to be the answer fades away. So, you know, the universal mind, basically, let's say at some point, will take itself to be all of reality. And, you know, it will understand that its own formal structure is behind everything that is. I mean, I'm not saying it the way Hegel would. But what Hegel would then go on to say is, but in knowing this, and this is what Hegel would say, in knowing this, universal consciousness loses materiality, loses particularity, loses the sensuousness, loses the real world, and becomes nothing but a bare abstraction. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but I think I'm pretty close to like quoting Hegel here. And that's something that if you know that Hegel said this about universal consciousness in the Phenomenology at various points along the way, it's things along those lines. For Marx to be saying it now about Hegel, it's kind of funny. It's not necessarily wrong, but he has to show that it's the case in Hegel with Hegel rather than assert it. And I feel like he asserts it here. He asserts it in a way that uses Hegel's language, but uses it sort of poorly. Like, you know, mind is not where Hegel ends up. And by the time we get to the end of Phenomenology, we're talking about a way of life rather than a concept.
And he's pointing at this idealism, right, that Mr. Varn, yeah, it used to be like the German where it's formal unless it's been indicated that you can do otherwise. Mr. Varn, he was arguing in there that you're sort of a Berkeleyan, you know, and so you have this problem of perception kind of always in your mind, whereas with Marx, there's almost like how he's arguing against Hegel here. There's this, let's not pay attention to the problem of perception anymore. Let's just deal with objects and real things as if they're not mediated by mind anymore. You know, like so he's almost wanting us to just say, you know, that normal pre-philosophical viewpoint of the world where it's just objects and you is the right one. And let's just go, let's just forget all that problem perception stuff. And get out of ideality, because if you follow the problem of perception stuff, it leads to where Hegel's led us, which is the problem of you know, that it's all ideas in your head. It's Berkeley, you know, it's all ideas in your head.
It might be argued that both naive and representative realism also have problems with distinguishing veridical perception. But whereas representative realism can distinguish between primary and secondary qualities, idealism can merely look at what information coheres well with other information. Realist perspective also seems counterintuitive. We think that we know that there's a world out there. We know that it continues to exist when there's no one else to see it. We're merely part of that world, merely fairly passive observers. There is the question of God. Berkeley uses God to bolster his position, suggesting that God continues to perceive objects when there is no other observer. There is no accepted rational a priori proof of the existence of God. The closest we can come to it is the ontological argument, which is accepted by very few modern philosophers. So we must conclude that for Berkeley to base his whole ontology, his whole theory of what exists, on an unproven premise is pushing it a bit. We'll be right back.
a couple of things there. One, I would say, is that that problem of perception is not Berkeley's alone. It's also, you know, Descartes' problem. It's later on Kant's problem. The empiricists in general had this problem, and I would say maybe it really starts with Descartes. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing is Berkeley's solution to the problem is very different from Hegel's solution. And Berkeley is a true and strict idealist. He doesn't believe in the materiality of the world. He believes that that concept of materiality is a incoherent concept. And so, not to go too far into Berkeley, but Berkeley does have this kind of, to put it in dialectical terms, a one-sided philosophy of mind that is an immaterial one. Hegel does not. Hegel wants to keep the particularity and he wants to keep the material and the objective in his philosophy, and he doesn't try to jettison it at all. In fact, his very starting point is to point out, or one of the starting points is to point out how consciousness itself, in order to be consciousness, necessarily has this concept of the objective.
Yeah, you're right. I misspoke there. I was using Berkeley as a placeholder for that whole argument because he's such an extreme example. Like, nobody argues against Berkeley being an idealist, right? You know, like clearly, at least there's that. And so, but I do agree with you on the Hegel that I've read so far, that he wants to preserve it, but there's a sense in which he really is still an idealist. You can't get away from that. And that's where Marx is breaking with him here in this essay, at least. Essentially, the lines that I was referring to earlier was where he's saying the philosophy of such and such is that thing, right? And for Hegel, which is, I don't even know how you follow that assertion at all. Like, I get that the whole argument develops into this moment where he makes these claims, and it's about, I don't know, towards the bottom of
everybody and their brother who's a philosopher wants to get away from Berkeley, you know? Mm-hmm. No one wants to end up as that kind of idealist. That's Kant's project, is partly to get away from that kind of idealism, and because it doesn't work. For one thing, it has its very obvious faults, and the one is it doesn't work in intuition. I mean, it just doesn't seem right. It seems crazy. But the other reason it doesn't work is because it's based on rejecting this concept of materiality, which is something that causes perception but is not perceptible. Is not a perception, basically. So that's his basis for rejecting matter as as an incoherent concept, is that it supposedly creates something from nothing, basically, because it creates perceptions from something that is by definition not a perception, not of perception. So then there's. That's his basis of his immaterialism, but his solution for what is the source of the world turns out to be something that is just like matter, basically something that is not perceptible itself. So he replaces one category that is creating something from nothing with another category that's creating something from nothing. So no one wants to do that.
But in Marx's critique in this essay of Hegel, Hegel's doing the same thing, basically. He's bringing in God at the last minute to save the day. I mean, it seems like, and this thus Feuerbach in the beginning is the first real person to use critical philosophy against Hegel and to point out the fact that we've basically, you know, used religion or God or whatever to, you know, help along this you know, project of Hegel's or something.
If Hegel brings in God at the very end, which he does literally in the Phenomenology mention God, like a little poetically at the end of Phenomenology, nothing like the way Berkeley does. But if he did bring in God at the ending of the Phenomenology, I think he also brings him in right at the beginning. Which also is a way of saying that he brings in
something from nothing, some concept that can create something from nothing, requiring the subject to have an object means that the subject has to rely on something that is not itself to exist. And that's the same thing as saying that something is coming from nothing. At the beginning of Hegel's logic, which I kind of glanced at, he has two categories, being and nothingness, and both are necessary, essentially, for there to be differentiation and for the world to come to be as we know it in the plurality.
Mm-hmm.
So Hegel doesn't accept Berkeley's argument about matter being an incoherent concept. That's where Hegel and Marx would both break with Berkeley.
Right.
So again, I mean, I'm maybe being unfair because you don't really mean to bring in Berkeley as he really is. He's a placeholder for theological thinking.
And idealism in this particular sense, which is really, like I said, really where I see Marx breaking with Hegel on the bigger than anything. And the lines in here, Feuerbach thus conceives the negation of the negation only as a contradiction of philosophy with itself, as a philosophy which affirms theology, the transcendent, after having denied it, and which it therefore affirms in opposition to itself. That, I think that particular line where he's kind of describing how, you know, he's breaking with Hegel, I think kind of sums up, you know, it's interesting that it's, you know, the whole history of philosophy, always people build on each other, but Feuerbach is kind of like an unknown to me, basically. But this notion that Marx is developing of the negation of the negation, you know, for Hegel, basically, if I'm getting this right, is where Hegel brings in kind of this religious mode of existence, this idealism, right? And we were kind of just at this situation where we were at in the phenomenology too, if I'm not mistaken. And I loved it. It's funny, like how much I loved it in Hegel when we got there, where he's positing the infinite, so we can get our moral selves appropriately adjusted. We have to have that post way far away, so we can, you know, walk a straight line while we're, you know, plowing or whatever. You know,
but that wasn't Hegel, right? That was Hegel describing Kant.
Yeah.
And so
true.
And so it was like Hegel describes Kant very well, and I remember the Bernstein lecture, he describes Kant as always having to posit this infinitely disappearing moral universe, this end of the road that we hope will never come so that we can continue to be moral creatures. Hegel ends up, though, actually posing that kind of infinitely distant morality and wants to bring it into the world. The thing about both Marx and Feuerbach is that they don't want to lose consciousness and human subjectivity as they embrace materiality. They may want to lose this problem of perception and forget about it, but they don't want to lose consciousness in the process of doing that. Because they're constantly referring to, you know, human sensuousness or human nature or the essence of the human. And all of that has to do with our ability to think and imagine and then act.
In the moment of contradiction, certain things are freed up, is one way I've heard it put. But more importantly, this shows you that something called determinate negation matters. And one example I could give of what determinate negation is this. So recently in the news, a guy got hurt really bad in public, and some Good Samaritan guy called an ambulance for him and basically saved the man's life. Later, the hospital hit him with the ambulance bill. And their response to him, and he didn't even know this guy, but their response to him was, well, listen, we have to hit somebody with the bill. And you, after all, were the one who made the phone call. And obviously, when all of us hear that, we think there is something wrong with that. But our reaction to it is not a simple negation. We say, not that. Our reaction to it implies a kind of idea of what would be better. In other words, our reaction to it is a determinate negation in which there's a sort of gesture towards what a resolution would be. Or perhaps another term you might use is there's a gesture towards what fulfillment would be. All right, so to go back to
the things they're rejecting is this equation of consciousness, self-consciousness that Hegel is doing, that it's all just kind of this flow into another, and it ends up only being able to be experienced by this philosophical method or whatever. Whereas for them, they're wanting to ground this nature with nature, kind of you still have consciousness, it's still a physical thing. Whenever I think of this, I think of like when I took philosophy of mind, and it was an analytic school, and there's a lot of different, you know, schools out there on how we get consciousness. Some just want to like say it's not there at all, but like the one that they ended up with was like it's a correlate to the body stuff that's going on, but it's not causally, it's like not directly causally linked or whatever. And I always like that kind of floating correlation of the mind with the physicality. The thing where I think it goes wrong is Descartes, right, where he completely separates the body and the mind, and then he picks a weird way. Like, I think they are separate, but he picks the wrong way. I think you can't have the mind unless you have a body. Like and where it seems like with Descartes, and that could be just a bad reading of Descartes, that he's saying you can have mind with no body, you know. And maybe it's, like I said, it's lost in translation for me.
What Descartes says is the basis for my understanding is the fact that I think. You know, I don't know that what I'm perceiving is real, but I know that I'm perceiving. Okay, so that could be read as I might not have a body. In fact, he does doubt the existence of his own body, but what he can't doubt is that he's thinking. So in that way, Descartes is an idealist. He starts with the perception. And that is something that I believe Hegel has in common with Descartes, is that they both start with perception, the fact that we have experiences.
Now, where do you think Marx is as far as that goes? Like, he's not starting with perception with his, is it something else? I mean, it seems like he's absorbing some of that. I mean, he has to start with perception, I guess you don't have to start with perception, but
I think Marx wants to hold on to human subjectivity and start with it, or that is at least what he's most concerned with. One thing he does is dismiss problems that arise from human subjectivity that are at the beginning of the phenomenology as abstractions relegated to the realm of philosophy and not of any concern for those of us who have understood Feuerbach.
Remarks obfuscate the key role of the Christian theology in the birth of modern science. I think this is true, that Christian theology played a crucial part. But which theology? What paved the way for modern science was precisely the voluntarist idea, elaborated among others by Duns Scotus and René Descartes, that God is not bound by any eternal rational truths. That is to say, while the illusory perception of the scientific discourse is that it is a discourse of pure description of facts, the paradox resides, of the paradox of modern science, in the coincidence of bare facticity, facts, and radical voluntarism. Facts can be sustained as meaningless, as something that just is the way it is, only if it is secretly sustained by an arbitrary divine will. This is why Descartes is the founding figure, one of the founding figures of modern science, precisely when he made even the most elementary mathematical facts, like 2 and 2 is 4, dependent on the arbitrary divine will. 2 and 2 is 4 because God willed it so, with no hidden obscure chain of reasons behind it.
He also, I think, appreciates Hegel for having, you know, developed alienation as central to humanity and humanity's productive capacities.
Now, but this alienation still is a moment where you're spiritualizing an object almost, right? Because if I came along and saw something, you know, it may have your alienated labor in there, but to me, it's you know, like as a child or whatever, I may not see anything alienated in there. It's just another sense perception on my eyeballs or something, you know, and it means nothing to me. There's nothing sacred there. You know, this seems like, is he making sacred that productive thing in the same way that he's arguing against Hegel as making, you know, perception itself sacred or something? I don't, you know, is there something?
Well, I think he probably, like a good Hegelian, means something different every time he says alienation, right? So going into the text, just finding the first time he says alienation, I'm going to read it, and then I don't know what I'm going to say about it. I'm just going to read it first. Because he says there's a double error in Hegel. The first emerges most clearly in the phenomenology, the birthplace of the Hegelian philosophy. When, for instance, wealth, state, power are understood by Hegel as entities estranged from the human being, this only happens in their form as thoughts. They are thought entities and therefore merely an estrangement of pure, abstract philosophical thinking. The whole process, therefore, ends with absolute knowledge. It is precisely abstract thought from which these objects are estranged, in which they confront with their presumption of reality. The philosopher, who is himself an abstract form of estranged man, takes himself as a criterion of the estranged world. The whole history of the alienation process and the whole history of the retraction of the alienation is therefore nothing but the history of the production of abstract thought, of logical speculative thought. Okay, what does all that mean? I think the accusation here is this, is that, there are different kinds of alienation in the world, and there's real alienation in the world, and then there's abstract alienation in the world. This is what Marx would say. So if you're talking about real alienation in the world, you're talking about, for instance, when you are a slave and you're forced to plant a lot of crops, but you're not allowed to eat any of them. That's real alienation in the world. Then there's abstract alienation in the world, which is the kind of alienation that arises in the realm of philosophy, where you're alienated from the world and your understanding of the world is separate from your sensation of it, say. So that you are alienated in your thought because your thought has produced a theory and an abstraction which demonstrates that you are alienated. That's a different kind of alienation.
Can I maybe ask a weird? So, like in your dreams, are you alienated from like because those aren't based on sense perception? So, is every dream this kind of same thing as the philosophy one, where you're kind of alienated from yourself, watching yourself act amongst the world, or whatever your dream world, or whatever? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So, you're asking is this realm of philosophy kind of like a dream world, where you're you know, boxing with shadows. You're not actually dealing with anything that's substantial in reality. I would say it isn't. The question is, is that what Marx is claiming? And I think it might be, but I'm not sure he's claiming that really fairly. I'm not sure he's right. The philosopher comes along and describes the slave as alienated from his labor rather than just starving. Alienation in itself is a philosophical concept. That real alienation, designated as real, is itself a philosophical move, and you can't really escape basically this movement of abstraction. You can't stop abstracting if you're trying to understand the world. That doesn't mean that your ability to understand the world stands apart from the world, or that you could be in a realm of pure abstraction without any sensuousness or materiality.
I'm sympathetic to Marx here because there's a certain sense that I do see this kind of super, like, I'm kind of anti-philosopher. As a philosopher, I'm anti-philosopher, because you do get to this point where you're alienated unnecessarily from your world, right? It's not the physical production of alienation. It's the thing you're doing to yourself.
While we were talking, I found Marx's theory of alienation online, and maybe I'll read it. So Marx was initially in the young Hegelian camp, and like Feuerbach, rejected the spiritual basis and adapted Hegel's dialectic mode or model to a theory of historical materialism. Marx's theory of alienation is articulated most clearly in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts and the German Ideology. The young Marx wrote more often and directly of alienation than the mature Marx, which some regard as an ideological break, while others maintain that the concept remains central. So there is generally held to be a transition from a philosophical anthropological Marxist humanism concept to a structural historical interpretation, accompanied by a change in terminology from alienation to exploitation to commodity fetishism and reification. Marx's concepts of alienation have been classed into four types: economic and social, political, human, and ideological. In the concept's most prominent use, it refers to the economic and social alienation aspect in which workers are disconnected from what they produce and why they produce. So I'll stop there. So that's Marx's view of alienation. But on the philosophical level, for Hegel, you could talk about alienation in the sense of where you are perceiving something and you feel as though you're cut off from it. When you're basically confronting the problem of perception, you're alienated from the world. When you say, I see a cup on my table here, but I can't know it, really. I can only know my perceptions of it, and it's really very alienated from me. A great philosophy of alienation would be Kant's philosophy of noumena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like the one that's beyond anything else, right? There is no connection. I mean, that's the central critique for Hegel that you don't have this noumena. Everything is part of your perceptions, right? Like that's one of the essential things, that everything is still in that container, whereas Kant says it's all out of the container and you'll never have access to it or whatever. You're completely alienated 100%.
But Kant's different from Berkeley because Kant needs that noumenal realm, whereas Berkeley says he can get rid of it. He replaces it with something just like it, God, but he thinks he can just be one-sided. Berkeley does. And Kant says, no, we've got, for us to be able to have these limited perceptions of the world, there has to be a noumenal realm which is undergirding it. It's supporting it. And if without that noumenal realm, we couldn't exist. But at the same time, we can say almost nothing of it. In fact, we can say nothing of it because it is outside of what is sayable or what is knowable or what is perceivable. But it must exist. We know that much. And Hegel comes along and says, well, actually, we can say quite a lot about it. You just did. Right? And we can say more.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Marx is, and I see where we're, you know, from where we read, kind of move on a little bit. Marx is talking about a humanism and a naturalism, and I think he opposes that from to the idealism and the materialism, you know. And this kind of naturalism is this direct natural being or whatever, you know. And this is why I think that's part of where I think that Marx is getting away from all this alienation and all this other things, and kind of reverting us back to the things that are right in front of us, this hunger for these objects, and you still have this object and, you know, subject or object of that subject type thing going on, but it's kind of lost its alienation there. It's just, you know, the sun and the plant are related, but yet they're outside of each other or something. They're both naturally related or whatever. He's developing this theory. You know, that mind, I think he's eventually getting to where mind is also a product of this naturalness that we have, this humanness that we have, right?
He would. And you know, but in that sense, the thing that's important to point out is that he does that in a Hegelian way, because he basically, the notion of human in Marx's talk here is the notion of both a physical animal and that physical animal's ability to estrange himself from the world,
mm-hmm.
and create the world in the process. And he says that, you know, in this essay a couple of different ways. And the humanness, so is always about man's productive capacities and man's abilities to understand and change the world. It's not only just that he is a being that reacts to the world, but that he is able to remove himself from it and make it his own, and then act upon the world. Those are both necessary parts of Marx's understanding of humanism. You know, and it's in here, but he's just not consistent in here. And he really wants to wrestle himself away from the idealism in Hegel, but he isn't really, I don't think he's successful in doing it. And
you go into that a little bit.
I stopped because I was realizing, well, why don't you find a passage to back yourself up? Well, he does say this: the outstanding achievement of Hegel's phenomenology and of its final outcome, the dialectic of negativity, as a moving and generating principle, is thus first that Hegel conceives the self-creation of man as a process, conceives objectification as loss of the object, as alienation ended, as transcendence of this alienation, that he thus grasps the essence of labor and comprehends objective man. True, because real man is the outcome of man's own labor. The real active orientation of man to himself as a species being or as manifestation of a real species being is only possible if he really brings out all his species powers, something which in turn is only possible through the cooperative action of all mankind. So, you know, we're not talking about understanding man as an object, you know, but as an active subject and self-creating subject.
Right, and this is where we're separating from Berkeley on some level, because we're in this kind of dynamic situation of, it's not you have your body, you have your mind, and you are interacting actively with the world. And you know, you have your ideas and then reality entering in at all times, and it's rather than kind of like, I don't know if I'm being fair to Berkeley there, but you have this kind of raw going through the motions of life, building upon that.
Marx isn't being one-sided or trying not to be one-sided. He's always actually arguing that Hegel is one-sided in this. And the problem with being one-sided is that, you know, you leave out the possibility of getting enough friction going to be able to move and change and to become something new. If you know, you don't want this ontology where basically the universe is one big block of cheese or a brick, and it's just all one thing, and it always will be the same. You want this flux and flow, which requires some opposition between two sides. So, you know, Marx does embrace Hegel's dialectic thinking. And that means that if you are going to side with the material world, you have to, you know, to do that, you know, successfully, you're going to end up having to posit at the same time something that isn't it, and that would be consciousness or representation or perception. So you can't just leave that out. I mean, there are materialists out there that are super hardcore that just believe that actually we don't know what we're talking about when we say perception and there is no such thing. But I don't understand them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because, like I said, I came from the analytic school, you know, a lot of times their philosophies were kind of like that. You know, materialism was the fact, and then the rest of it was kind of, you know, some were dualist in that format, but they were. You had a lot of work to do to prove to the rest of the people that were, you know, doing it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that view. You know, I personally like a little bit more mental going on. I think I find mental to be pretty primary, but as well. But, you know.
Well, you know, sometimes I feel like with these guys on the left, and maybe Marx is like this, that there's this desire to get away from a certain sort of mysticism where what that means is that something weird is going on. They want things to be kind of plain and logical and, you know, no nonsense. And there's certainly some sort of nonsense in Hegel. There's, you know, it's meticulously argued and it's always reasoned out. But the feeling of it is not no nonsense. The feeling of it, if you grasp it, is a little bit weird. And I think Marx doesn't want to have any of that weirdness in his socialism. Thank you very much. And so, I mean, that's maybe far away from you know, being rigorous or fair to Marx, but I think that's true. I think that if you ever just gone to a socialist meeting, they're nothing like going to a New Age seminar. And they just don't put up with that very well. So having said all that, I think that the best way to understand Hegel's dialectics isn't, well, today, for me, isn't to think of it as two simple sides, but to think of it as two sides that are weirdly twisted. And the short story, I remember I told, I went to this short story at the very beginning of the first Hegel workshop that we did, which was this story of the electric ant. And the electric ant was this Philip K. Dick story where the guy discovers he's in a car wreck and he discovers he's an android because he goes to the hospital and they say, "We can't treat you, you're not a human, you're filled with tubes and wires." And he opens up the front panel on his chest and finds that there's a card feed there, that, and it turns out the unit that's taking the cards is his perceptual unit. So he sees whatever the card punch to, you know, is programmed for him to see. And what makes this Hegelian is that when he takes the card punch, the paper, the card disappears, and as does the whole world. That without the relationship between the card punch and his mechanism, there wouldn't be a world of perception, and that for Hegel, you have to have this relationship between the two things, or else. You've got something undifferentiated and that's just not present. But that does seem to be, there's this sort of solipsistic quality to the story, and for that relationship to matter, that means that consciousness matters. That means if you ask the question, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? The proper answer is what tree? You know.
Right. Well, and that actually sounds very Marxian, right? Like, you know, the you didn't really have. I mean, you have this hypothesized tree, but there is no tree at all, right?
Zoom right and left. Lacma, and we're looking at Magritte's The Treachery of Images from 1929, or also called N'est pas un pipe. This is not a pipe.
Okay, so, but it's a hilarious painting.
It is hilarious. It's an incredibly real painting of a pipe.
Magritte paints in this incredibly wonderful, matter-of-fact, kind of absolutely mundane, illustrative style.
Yes, like he was illustrating a catalog.
And with the words underneath, it's as if you're looking at one of the flashcards you would have as a child.
Right, that would say, pipe, and but it's just, this is not a pipe.
That's right. And of course, he's right. It's not a pipe. It's a painting of a pipe.
But it is a pipe.
Where is the authority? Do we believe what we're seeing in the veracity of the illustration, the sort of perfect representation of the almost platonic pipe?
It's the ore pipe.
It's the ore pipe, yes. Right, exactly. Or do we believe the text underneath, which tells us it's not a pipe? Which is stronger, the representation of the thing or the language that denies it?
For me?
Yeah, for you.
The picture of the pipe.
The picture of the pipe is more powerful than the language.
Yes.
That's so interesting, because I think for most, and maybe that's because you're an art historian, and you just
that's why I became an art historian.
Maybe so.
I believe whatever I see.
Because so many people believe what they read, and in a sense, I think the language has a kind of authority. But for me, there's this sort of perfect, almost balance and struggle between the two, where I just absolutely accept that pipe. It's there. It's this pipe. It's this perfect representation of a pipe. And the language is completely denying it and has tremendous authority as well. And it's this fantastic tension between that presentation and then that rejection of the presentation.
And then, of course, there's the word pipe, which is, in a way, just as much of an abstraction from the actual item of the pipe.
Okay. So the representation of the pipe is twofold. There's the representation of the pipe
as an image.
As an image, this iconic.
And then there's the word.
Okay, so this linguistic symbol.
Yeah.
Right. And they're both not a pipe.
They're both not a pipe.
That's right. They're both actually ways of representing a pipe, or our notion of what that pipe is in somebody's mouth somewhere.
What else could this be a picture of?
Well,
it's a picture of, it is a pipe.
So it is.
It's
so
like,
you're, so it's you're
like
denying
they occupy the
text.
The same.
Flying car today, ended up in the hospital without a hand. Doctors, they said they couldn't do a thing for me because I wasn't a man. I was an electric. I'm an electric ant. Now I see I can change my own reality. Called my secretary.